This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Forever Dog.
Now this Mario Brothers movie.
I'm going to just say this. This Mario Brothers movie, we got to shut this one down. We shut down Sonic the Hedgehog movie, never came out. We did it.
Yep.
Mission accomplished. Wait a minute, it did come out.
I'm going to storm the Capitol again. We're going to get all the everything they used to storm the Capitol. I'm going to get pepper spray. I'm going to get a podium. Mm-hmm. Whatever they use, I'm going to use until they fix this casting.
Yeah, I'm getting my pals from the state, and we are taking
the sketch
it
comedy to
the,
group.
Yes. I figure there's enough of them that we can make a difference.
There's so many people.
38 members of the state.
They were like the, what was that band again? The Polyphonic Spree of sketch comedy.
Yes. Where there's just like, oh, there's more of you. Okay. Where it's like a clown car and they just kept getting out of the clown car. Except they were really clowns. They really were clowns. I don't know what to say. My childhood has been ruined.
Once again, my childhood has been ruined.
The worst Chris Pratt, is doing a voice on this.
And not just a voice, the voice.
Who's Luigi? It would be funny if it was Steve Schrippa.
Who is doing Luigi?
Brett.
Charlie Day, I believe, was cast to do Luigi.
There you go.
It's weird.
Star of
I Love You, Daddy.
I Love You, Daddy, and Pacific Rim.
It's a lovely day today for whatever you got to, Charlie.
Day after day. Right?
Day by day. Oh, Charlie. These things I pray, that it stay always sunny in Philadelphia.
They're heading toward one of those deals with that show where they're like, that's going to be an 18 season endeavor. And then people are going to be like, why are they still doing it? It's like, because all you did was scream about why they needed to keep doing it. Well, they can't stop making it. Why are they still making it?
Right.
Like it just turns immediately. People just turn immediately.
Right.
Am I wrong? Am I wrong about this?
Who are you looking at?
Am I wrong?
You look around your room as though there are people there. Do you have two Funko Pops that you keep looking at?
I have a Funko Pop of you and a Funko Pop of Brett. And I just have them here. And I do the show every day. It's a daily. Double Threat has been a daily show, actually. It is the daily show, the new daily show.
You should turn on the recorder and start.
Oh, I do. You should hear the tapes.
Patreon.
You should hear them.
That'll be like when you're arrested, they'll be like, there'll be a true crime documentary. Like, we found a disturbing tapes and sharplings.
A Zoom recorder filled with over 200 hours of episodes of Double Threat, which only featured Tom.
The police recovered disturbing audio footage of Sharpling speaking to invisible hosts.
One episode topped out at 80 hours.
And the victims are like, I wish this true crime documentary were less about the killer. Mm-hmm. And then everyone else is like, but the killer's so interesting.
Yeah. I love killers. Let me finish. I love that we have a great culture now where you can be a cool bad guy.
Finally.
Like Tiger King, like this guy, Tiger King. He's a bad guy, right?
I can't believe they cast Chris Pratt as the friggin' tiger.
Hold on a second. Who's playing Tiger King?
No, the tiger.
Who's playing the tiger?
Who's playing Tony the Tiger again?
Hold on. Chris Pratt is playing Tony the Tiger? The worst Chris? No thanks. I'm out.
The worst Chris and the best cereal mascot?
Yes, I'll watch it three times, but I'm out. No way. I'm out. When's it open? I'm out. I watched it. I'm out. Watched it again. I like it. I'm out.
I'm out. I'm out to the movie theater.
I'm out to the movie theater again to see it. I'm out. The worst Chris? No thanks. Two for Tony the Tiger, please.
One for me and my giant stuffed animal of Tony the Tiger.
Can I also buy tickets for the next six showings and just not get up? I have to get up? I'm out. I'm out of the theater because you guys got to clean it. What? I can't just sit here all afternoon? I'm out.
I'm out.
Two for Tony the Tiger again, please. Yes, it's me. Yes, it's me waving my Tony the Tiger stuffed animal that I'm behind, trying to pretend that he's ordering the tickets this time, because I don't think you want to let me back into the theater.
I said I was out. These tickets are for Tony.
These are Tony's. What, you won't sell tickets to a stuffed animal? I'm out. Yes, I bought them. I went on movie phone and bought the tickets and just held my phone up to the scanner. That was me again. I didn't go. I superseded the ticket window. I'd like some Raisinets, please. You're out. You're out of Raisinets. You're out. I'm out.
And then he goes to Walgreens. I'd like some Raisinets.
10 for 10, eh? Okay. Right next to the drugstore, right next to the movie theater. Greatest deals on candy that just happens to be in movie theater-shaped boxes.
Honestly, when you think about it, you're like, capitalism has some blind spots.
Yeah. You're like,
where you can legal, like if I were the movie theater, I'd be like, how is this even legal? Yeah, you have a building next to my building that has candy that's like 10% of the cost of the candy I'm selling in bigger boxes.
Yeah. Literally put it in your pocket. We cannot find it. What are we supposed to do? Pat downs at the movie theater now?
That'd you can bring amazing, in though. Honestly, I've yes, I agree. I can't wait for that reality.
Julie, I just think we just hit the greatest. Here's the greatest invention. I'm looping you in 50-50 partner on this.
What?
If we can become billionaires. Get this.
Brett,
I'll throw you 10. It's 40-40 20.
I didn't want to ask, but I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay.
How much does that?
Cuz you didn't want to ask. It's 35-35-30.
That's pretty good.
I didn't agree to that.
Well, you didn't hear the deal yet. I might loop you right out and run away.
Don't.
It could be 100-0-0.
Is this just about pat downs?
No. It's the greatest idea I've ever had in my life.
What is
it? You and I get to work. We invent. Get this. Are you sitting down?
I hope so.
Well, I can see you are. So we invent metal detectors that detect candy.
Only candy?
Yeah. For movie theaters?
Candy detectors.
Candy detectors that go up right after you buy the ticket, but before you get to the concession stand. You walk through a candy counter scanner.
That's a great idea.
Do you know how much money we would make selling this thing to movie theaters?
I will settle for, if my payout, you can do the percentage however you want, but I want my payout to include the giant Tupperware bin that they use to confiscate all the candy.
Absolutely.
I want that. I want that candy.
You got it.
That giant, like, TSA size Tupperware where people are like, you know, junior mints.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you get it? So those little mini Charleston chews you can get at CVS that you don't even have to unwrap. You just tilt your head back and then fill your mouth with small bars.
Milk duds. Mm-hmm. Milk duds you get in those boxes at the CVS. But just picture
Jujubes.
Meep, meep. Beeps.
Uh-huh.
You have to do the wand over the person, and then you just find they got a Kit Kat bar.
Right.
In their sock.
What about chips or fruit? They can keep it. I think fruit should be, I don't think you should be allowed to bring fruit into a movie theater.
Yeah, let's make it so that we sell fruit at the movie theater.
But then ushers are going to trip on banana peels and people are going to not be able to hear dialogue over the crunching into apples.
I don't want people laughing. If I write some hit movie and I'm just like, this is the funniest thing I've ever done. And I go in the theater, the big premiere, and then suddenly an usher slips on a banana peel because some clown did it. I hear like, you're laughing at the wrong part. Like, I would just jump up.
Everybody laughs at the usher.
Yeah, they laugh at the usher. No, that wasn't one of my jokes. You're laughing at the wrong, start it over.
You can't go to every movie theater and scream start it over. Projectionist.
Start it over.
That was my favorite part in Inglourious Bastards.
Which
when
part?
When Goebbels was like, start it over.
Yeah, Goebbels. Not into
box
it.
Box seats for Goebbels. Yeah. I know you've had problems with him in the past. I know you had beef. I know you clapped back.
Julie.
What?
I hate one of these bastards more than the next. To quote.
Not the Inglourious Bastards.
I hate these. Hitler. Himmler.
Hurler.
Goebbels.
We discussed Hurler.
Goering.
An earring would be the lady.
Yeah.
Hurler wears earrings.
Hurler, yes. Finally, you wanted Hitler. Now you got Hurler.
Yeah, no, I was going to say Titler.
Perfect. We are a font of ideas today.
Yeah,
the
font is Comic Sans.
It is Comic Sans, and we are bringing the comic. We are not sans comedy. We are Avec comedy today here on Double Threat, and this is Double Threat. Look at the
welcome
way we took it.
Welcome to the show.
There. Can you believe it? You all think we're going down a wrong road and we forgot where we are, and then we bring the landing in.
Abracadabra.
I gotta start charging a finder's fee on these segues.
Congratulations. What? I just want to say welcome to Double Threat, the launch of the show. We took a little detour there, but we landed
on
time.
We're on our way to our destination. In fact, we are remember, you know how like pilots always brag when they're early? They love telling, I almost said the audience.
We got in 15 minutes early, so
you're welcome.
We'll make the baggage take that much longer, so you're still 5 minutes late.
I just want to bring this back to me for a second. I'm the one who got us in early. I took a sneaky shortcut. It was really cool. My co-pilot was actually kind of a pussy about it. Said, don't do that. It's windy. I did it anyway. And we're 15 minutes early. So when you leave, don't look at my co-pilot in the eye. He sucks shit. And I'm awesome.
I also just want to say that if you happen to be in the gate 17, there's a Sbarro. And they've got some pretty good pizza there.
Probably the best margarita slice you can get at LAX.
Also, please don't unfasten your seatbelt, even though we're taxiing on the runway now.
We're going to be taxiing for 45 minutes because we are 15 minutes early, as I mentioned.
The plane is now going 1 mile an hour driving across the runway, but please do not unfasten your seatbelt until we are at the thing. Like, I would love to see somebody get, like, you hear like the like when it's too early, and then suddenly you hear, oh, I I unfastened it too soon. I banged my head.
Bang my kepi. You know that's Yiddish for head.
Kempi?
Kepi.
Kepi. Okay.
Isn't that cute? Isn't that cute?
My kepi.
You put your kepi on the pillow to go schluffy.
Okay. I like that.
Yiddish words are cute.
Mm-hmm.
And funny.
When a plane lands, Julie, when do you unfasten that seatbelt? When it actually stops at the gate?
No, when I am instructed to by a member of the crew.
Oh, I do pop that thing a little early. I got to admit.
Not me.
Not right away. But
not me.
When I see the gate come, when I see the little thing coming up, the little tunnel tube, I'm like, okay, we're in the home stretch here. We're not taking off again.
No, you have to listen to orders. You have to listen to orders, and you have to do what they tell you to do.
Really?
Yeah. Otherwise, you're going to be like Jim Brewer. Right? Brett's nodding. Brett saw Jim Brewer's latest videos where he's angry about people doing what they're supposed to do, and he calls us sheep, and it's not nice. Mm-hmm. And people who have jokes about him being goat boy or taking horse pace while he's calling a sheep. Yes, those are the funniest jokes in the world. And yes, I enjoy laughing at them. And sure, I see how they're using animals.
Mm-hmm.
But I do what I'm supposed to do because I'm a good girl. I'm a star pupil.
I think that's great that you are... You respect the rules.
And you're a bad boy of the air. Yeah. And you unclick that seatbelt.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I'm sure your pal Jim Brewer does the same thing.
I do want to say that we should probably lay off the Jim Brewer stuff on a serious note, because Forever Dog actually does have a new show. It's Brett.
Yes. It's called The Brewery.
It's called The Baker. It's called the Glazer and the Brewer. And it's about...
We haven't announced it yet, so this is an exclusive right here. This is exclusive.
Yep. Jim Brewer brews different batches of beer that they try to match with...
Brett pairs.
That Brett pairs with different fishes and... Yeah.
We're looking for a candlestick maker, too, by the way.
Do you think this pineapple IPA goes well with this halibut?
Mahi-mahi, maybe? Yeah.
Let's pair this with a mahi-mahi, a very flaky. This fish is kind of oily, a little heavy. That's why I tried to counter it with a lighter glaze. You know, the vaccine is just madness. Like, they're just like, that's what the show is. It's like,
he's Brett's just like, talking about vaccines, and Brett's like trying to keep it on topic.
Yeah, Brett's like, I tried a honey wasabi glaze on this one. I figured I'd try something for a more oily, heavier fish. I figured I'd try
like a lighter, fresher kind of flavor.
Yeah, this is good stuff. You know what else is the good stuff? Ivermectin.
I poured
some ivermectin on this fish fillet sandwich.
Fish fillet sandwich. Brett, would you be offended if someone took one of your fish creations and just like slapped it on a bun with some tartar sauce? Would you feel that would be disrespectful?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. You know, I think that's the great thing about fish. You can go high with it. You can go low with it. You can go right in the middle. You know, fish is a very versatile food. Mm-hmm. And I certainly don't look, you know, I love a good, fried fish sandwich down by the seaside. So I certainly don't look ill on anyone who slaps a piece of fish on a sandwich and calls it a day.
Well, maybe the word slap is what's making it seem like there's an issue here. They slap it on a, they go into Brett's kitchen with a loaf of Wonder Bread. And they, give me that fish.
You know, I was thinking recently about whether Brett doing rubs and glazes for fish will ever not be funny or interesting to us. And I don't think it will.
You don't think it'll ever be interesting?
No,
I agree.
No, ever not be interesting. Okay. Like, I feel like he said that because there was a best of that you published, Brett, earlier this year. It was like best of 2021. And you mentioned this Grubbs and Glazes thing this year. This is not like, this is like a relatively new discovery. And we have mentioned it 7 or 8 times on every episode we've done since.
It's now, I think there's episodes where we didn't say our names, but we said something
this
about
one, Brett. This one, for example. This one so far.
Yeah. Now Brett is rolling in his kitchen. He's going to make some rubs and glazes. Make some rubs and glazes. He's going to make some rubs and glazes with fish.
For
gonna
fish.
Make some rubs and glazes for fish.
And I am going to say, you know, I know we have like a very exciting A-list guest coming up.
Incredible guest coming up.
I'm going to pitch that we lay off talking about rubs and glazes for fish because I feel like it's going to confuse our guests.
Well, no, we won't. Look,
he seems game for it, though.
Julie, let's hold some votes right now. You and I.
I feel like I know what Brett's vote is based on what he just muttered.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying just you and I. Okay, here I propose a vote that today.
Yeah.
When our esteemed guest comes on.
A-lister.
First, we got to make it clear that Brett is the producer.
A producer and not the co-host.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to end up. I'm not going back in that zone again. I'm not going back with this one.
As God is my witness, you'll never dwell in those shadows again.
Thank you. I just don't want. He'll be like, "Hey, Julie. Hey, Brett."
Well, Robin Colombo said, "Hey, Julie. Hey, Brett.
Hey, Chris.
I'm so happy to be here."
Then, "Hey, Chris Gethard."
Yeah.
I'll visit her in jail.
So the vote is that we shouldn't talk about Robs or Glazes when our A-list. And by the way, Jim Brewer might be the GOAT. Boy, this guy's the GOAT. When he comes on, we don't talk about this thing that we're, as I mentioned, obsessed with.
Yeah, these are the things we don't talk about today in front of this guest.
Okay.
Rubs. Glazes.
What about marinades?
Marinades. Definitely not marinades. I wouldn't know how to begin talking about compound butters. No marinades.
Brett, if you had a girl, would you have named her Marinade?
It would have been in the running. Lady Marinade.
Yes, Creole Lady Marinade.
Yeah. Marinade. Brett's like, whoa, hey.
Amy's trying to sleep.
Yeah. 5:30 in the morning. Why are you singing Lady Marmalade like that? And our child's name is not Marinade. Brett's like, well, what if our kid was named Marinade? Our kid's not named Marinade. This didn't happen. Why are you doing this? I'm having a hard time.
He's right.
The pressure's really getting to me.
He writes an original song about the song he's singing called I'm Gonna Serenade to My Marinade.
Yeah. Our child is not named Marinade, though, Brett.
I'm trying to wake the baby up.
Tom. Yeah,
with great music.
Tom, did you listen to the unhinged 3-minute? No, I loved it, Brett. I stopped it in the middle. I could not stop laughing.
I saw something went up last night, and then Tom, I saw a tweet where you were just like, I was like, I don't know what this is. And then you immediately tweeted, we didn't know this was happening. And I was just like, the show's tomorrow. I'm taking it to the airwaves.
Yeah.
What
we
is
were
it?
Not we were not told, we were not warned, we were not told. All of a sudden from the Double Threat account, I see an announcement with a photo of salmon attached to it saying bonus glazed. Episode glazed salmon.
Yeah.
Saying
bonus episode.
Yes. I'm going about my Friday business. I'm preparing for the Sabbath.
Everybody listening might as well just start making bonus episodes. That, let's see how far we can crack open what constitutes an episode of Double Threat. I would say one of the mainstays needs to be that the double threats are on the show
that we know about it.
I'd say there's two things. We know about it and we appear on it. kind of, I think that's maybe the 101s of what constitutes an episode of Double Threat being
or I'm going to say this, or one of us is on it.
At least one of us is on it. And we don't find out about it on Twitter.
Yeah.
Oh, hey,
when you're front of house, which I am, you don't take everything back to the green room. You know, sometimes a problem presents itself and you just say, you know, I'll take this. I'm not going to bother. The stars.
We're not in the green room, buddy. We're in the boardroom.
Mm-hmm.
You bring it to the boardroom.
Tom, you got to hear this. Brett?
Yes.
Will you please play the part where you sing?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Didn't get around to auto-tuning myself, so this is just raw.
I just want to put this out there, Brett, because we do give you the business, and yeah. I loved it.
Okay.
Oh, thank you so much.
I loved
thank
it. You.
Oh, no,
I
I'm excited it. About it. I think it's exciting.
Last week, I think I was a little mean to you. I think it was harder on you than usual, and it's only because I'm just telling you right now, I don't like being abandoned for babies or otherwise.
Sure, understood.
You
understood.
Left us for a week.
Well, this was my way of saying, I'm back, baby.
Okay.
No, he's saying he's back to his baby.
Well, he's back.
Oh, yeah, sorry, guys. I was talking to the baby.
He's back,
baby. See you later.
He's clearly back to back with things that are preventing him from making choices, like telling Tom and Julie if they're posting a freaking bonus episode where he's just him singing to himself.
I'm back, baby. See you non-babies later.
Mm-hmm. Fine.
All right. So let's hear this.
The point being is that I have a little song that I like to sing whenever I'm feeling down, all about my favorite things, and it goes a little like this.
Oh my goodness. You gotta be kidding me.
Glazes on fishes and rubs also on fishes. Some parts of Georgia and Knott's Berry sliders. Look, it's Ray Winstone, he's in Sexy Beast. These are a few of my favorite things.
Okay, stop.
I'm just gonna say, cancel our guest. This needs to be fully analyzed and broken down.
Speaking of suitcases, this needs to be unpacked.
Yes.
Unpacked.
Or speaking of suitcases, this needs to be put in one and thrown into a river.
I mean, Tom, have you ever? Can I ask you a question? Let's back up. What did you expect versus what did you just hear?
What I just heard was Rodgers and Hammerstein rolling over in their graves. I just heard them. Banging on their coffins from inside, trying to get out to finally, they're going to get you, Brett.
Vengeance. It's a vengeance thriller.
They're going to malignant you.
I did have some trouble with the rhyme scheme. Sorry, guys.
You know, when somebody rhymes glazes with also glazes, it's a little bit of a heads up for what's coming down the pike.
Beast with things.
I pronounce it things though, so I kind of made it.
No, this is great.
This actually, frankly, makes me nervous that we're no longer necessary. I think that's what I'm reacting to.
I kind of feel like we've been replaced.
This is all about Eve stuff.
Yeah.
No, this doesn't exist without you. This is the Frankenstein monster that you've created. This is, you know, I don't even recognize myself anymore listening to this.
That great moment when you're just like, wait, who did I become? You're like, hold on a second. Who am I now?
I don't even like half this shit.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, how did I get all the way over here? It happened one little step at a time. I'm pretty far away from where I was. Wow, look, I can't even see where I used to be from here anymore, and I didn't even know I was moving.
Yeah,
it's like being out in the ocean and suddenly you're just like, where's our towel?
Right.
Oh, halfway down the beach we got moved far away.
Yeah. And then you're Tom Hanks talking to a volleyball.
Yeah. Where's our towel? I think we got some bigger problems. What's that? I saw Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks arguing with a volleyball.
And he was shredded.
And he was jacked.
Hi, everybody. Tim Heidecker here to tell you about episode 292 of Office Hours Live with our special guest, documentary filmmaker Lance Oppenheim, and musical guests, Melinda Sullivan and Larry Goldings. You can find us on your podcast app of choice. And at goodbye.
YouTube. And at YouTube.com.
And at YouTube.com/goodbye.
/Office Hours Live.
I had two whiskeys last night, and I ended up housing two veggie dogs on the street. I had two whiskeys and a beer.
Like, keep them coming. One more.
And then I went to Criff Dogs on St. Mark's. I haven't been to since I was a co-ed.
Okay.
I said, give me two veggie dogs and don't be stingy with the kraut.
And the next thing I knew, I was, because I'm like, no, it's not for here. It's to go. Cut to me on like 2nd Avenue.
Fine, it's for here.
Just it's housing for, them.
And you're
housing,
like,
stuffing them in my mouth.
Yeah, they're to go. And then you walk 6 steps. You're like, now they're for here.
Yeah. That's exactly what happened. I didn't want to eat in there. It would be unladylike.
I went and got a sandwich the other day, and then I was like, am I going to eat this in this place? No, I'm getting this to go. And then I get in the car, I'm like, can I eat it literally right in front of the place?
I know.
And I was like, no, I can't. So I drove 2 blocks away, still ate it in my car, just not in front of the place.
I don't want it on a plate. I want it in a bag. A bag is my plate. Thank you very much. Yeah. Now, here's the thing with sauerkraut. When you bite into it, there's always going to be stuff like hanging off of it, of the hot dog.
Yeah, it's not a very elegant topping.
No! So your brain is like, quick, catch that sauerkraut with another bite.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So you end up, it's almost like a real life video game. Like, yeah, like a cat eating string, and you get towards the cat, you're like, stop it, and they just eat it faster.
Mm-hmm. Do you take Jimmy Jazz out to the veggie dog stand?
Take me out to the hot dog
stand.
I'm a tuxedo cat.
Yeah.
Buy me some hot dogs with sauerkraut.
Meow, 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 meow.
Mom is a pig. She has two hot dogs on 2nd Avenue.
I don't like that.
2nd Avenue, 11 p.m. Well, listen, you just made your cat call you a pig. If anyone saw me.
I'm going to go over there. I'm going to punch that cat in the face for saying that.
Please. Only if it takes out his way about my friend Julie. If you take out his 5 remaining teeth, I will pay you not as much as I would pay the doctor to do it, but I'll still pay you.
Look, you cat bastard. You don't talk that way about my friend Julie.
If anyone saw me on 2nd Avenue last night,
get out from under that
bed. Inhaling 2 hot dogs, it was not me.
That was not Julie.
It was not me.
It was Ghoulie.
It's almost Crypt Keeper season.
Yeah. John Kassir, right now, you're sitting high, buddy. You're flush.
Mm-hmm.
Probably now he's like, let's buy it. Time to pull the trigger on that flat screen. Yes, hello, Best Buy. How much is a 32-inch flat screen?
So how about a flat screen? They tell him it's too much money. And then he's like, well, then how about a flat screen?
How much for a flat screen?
Well, and speaking of John Kassir, I've got a guest in the waiting room right now that could act circles around John Kassir.
Oh, my God. I can't believe it. Tom, do you believe this?
I don't. I'll believe it when it happens.
One of the best actors working. One of the best actors. And I'll tell you, maybe I'll tell you this. Well, no, I'll tell you this before he comes on. So this week I kind of did all my research about Paul Walter Hauser because I loved him in Cruella and I loved him and I Think You Should Leave. And then I went back and I watched Richard Jewell. I was blown away. I thought this is like a first class. Honestly, I'm going to break this out. Like I wish I could have seen him act with Philip Seymour Hoffman. I am not sparing yes. praise when I tell you this guy is of the caliber of, I mean, I was just blown away.
It's like when people fall from the sky, when you don't know who they are. And the last time I felt like that was with, how is it? Brian Tyree Hill. Is that his full name?
Henry. Brian Tyree Henry.
When he was on Atlanta. And it was just like, who is this guy? And like, you don't even know like how much acting they're doing in terms of who they are as actual people. And you're just not clear on that. And that's the best. That means you're lost in the performance. And that's just the best. That means you're buying the performance completely.
Yes.
Well, and speaking of completely, this next guest completes me. Tom and Julie, please say hello to Paul Walter Hauser.
Yay! Oh, my goodness. How are you? Hey.
Couple quick questions.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Can I eat a rotisserie chicken during the
I'm gonna say yes.
Okay. Yes.
To that. Can I this is already the greatest episode of the show ever.
That's not true.
The guest offering to eat a rotisserie
most
chicken.
Most guests just do it. They don't even ask.
I can't imagine what the next question is going to be.
Swear words, yay or nay?
Oh, you can curse, sure.
Absolutely. Curse your balls off.
I love chicken. I love swearing.
Oh, this is so exciting. We have on the show right now Paul Walter Hauser. And this is, I'm not going to put down the usual guests we get here, Paul. We get a cavalcade of great of people in all different. You really do like chicken. You were not lying. You
there's nothing left on that bone.
Yeah. Now,
I just lost 40 pounds to play a serial killer for this Apple show.
Uh-huh.
So when I get to eat, it's like vaguely sexual and bothersome.
Sure. Well, Paul, I think I found the 40 you lost, and I'm currently carrying them all 40. And I found an extra 5 past that 40. No.
Beautiful. No matter what they say, words can't bring you down. Those are lyrics.
Yeah, that's Christina Aguilera, the great. Now, we are excited. This is what we call in the biz a get. This is a get. And we got a get. How are you?
I'm spoiled. Thanks for having me on the show. I got to tell you, big fan of Julie's. Back in, I think it was 2015, I got Hulu. And just like everybody else, I said, what is this weird thing that won't last? And then...
It was called Difficult People.
No, I meant Hulu as a streaming service.
No, I get it.
People.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Give me 30 seconds to be a weirdo and just point out Difficult People was easily the funniest show since like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and Kimmy Schmidt. Mm-hmm. It understood its tone in a way that few things do. The guest stars alone should validate the show more than an Emmy win could ever validate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Andrea freaking Martin Short. Yep. I mean, just like SNL stars galore, but then also cool, like random people that you wouldn't even think of. And, you know, the fact that it lasted 3 seasons and not 7 or 10 upsets me, but I love it to pieces. And it made me laugh during a time when I was still struggling trying to do the actor gig. This is a show me and my friends watched, and like it cheered us up when we were broke as shit auditioning for guest stars.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. And you missed it, but we were singing your praises before you came on, and I compared you to Philip Seymour Hoffman. Remember, Tom? Remember?
Yes, you did.
Because I was a huge fan of you from Cruella. I thought you were a British guy. I didn't recognize you at all. I really did. And then I obviously loved you on I Think You Should Leave. You made me very angry at Jamie Taco. And then I finally, this week, caught up and I finally watched Richard Jewell. And I thought, holy shit, there was that. I was just completely blown away. Oh, and goodness. That must have been, I mean, was that, obviously it must have been intimidating to be like in scenes with Kathy Bates and directed by Clint Eastwood. And
yeah, but you were just. I want to break that down. I want to get.
Yeah, let's, can we talk about that a little bit before we get into the fun stuff? Well, I mean, I guess this is I'm having fun at
least. I also do want to just say, not that I'm a bigger fan of you, but I remember in 2010 when I saw you as Dale in Virginia, I was like, this guy has something. And then I watched Community and I saw Student Number 3 and I was like, circle this name.
You tell you, Student Number 3 is what got me that lake house. what got me the grotto on my pool. Dude, Virginia was a big deal for me. I had seen the movie Milk and loved it and cried watching it. And then Lance won his Oscar for writing it. And I cried during his speech. And so I just went to be a background actor, like an extra at the casting call for his directorial debut in my home state of Michigan. And I saw him and I walked up to him and I was like, you know, I'm a weirdo. I'm like a big Jesus guy, but I'm also pretty liberal. And I love my LGBTQ plus times 1,000. So I walked up to him and was like, hey, dude, in your speech, when you said God doesn't hate gay people, like that needs to be said way more to the folks who don't get it. And I just really appreciate it and wanted to say congrats. And I hope the film turns out great. Literally 40 seconds of blather of me just, if I got to meet Lance Black once, that's what I'd want to say to him. And I ended up with like, I think the sixth biggest part in the movie. And I got to work with Jennifer Connelly and Ed Harris and all these amazing people. So I really owe my break to Lance Black. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, I love that guy and that movie. The movie didn't do that well, but like it meant a lot to me, you know?
Mm-hmm. So it starts off, you're an actor, you're in Michigan.
Yeah.
You grew up in Michigan. When did you make the move out of, like, what? When did you make your big step toward acting? Like, what was the first thing where you're saying, hey, I'm an actor, I got to go all the way in on this?
I was obsessed with it, dude. I was just like, I watched the Oscars and the Golden Globes, every People magazine. And like, I went through all my old shit at my sister's house the other day. She was so kind of like, her and her husband let me put like 10 boxes of my crap from high school and college in their basement. And I went through it the other day and I was looking at it and like, I saved like People magazines and TV guides and like just random weird hoarder stuff. Mm-hmm. It was not unlike those sad girls who are like, Justin Bieber is my boyfriend. He just doesn't know it yet. And they're like crying at the concert. Mm-hmm. That was me. But with like Brian Cox.
Like Brian Cox is my grandfather.
Do you prefer his Lecter? Where does his Lecter sit on your scale of Lecters? we don't have to rate all my Lecter
scale. I really got to stop tweeting when I'm drunk.
You just played a serial killer.
Yeah, I'm still playing them. Yeah.
Oh no. To chickens at least, rotisserie chickens.
Yeah.
Listen, I just like Lecter, I put this chicken skin on my face.
Sergeant John Pemery.
No, I think Cox is right up there with Homeboy, with Sir Tony Hoppy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why I'm kind of moving like a pigeon today. Doing a little head nod thing.
You're moving in a grooving.
Yeah.
Moving and grooving. I was obsessed with the whole acting thing and I decided I'd move to LA. I didn't know I'd get to move there with like $8,000 to my name out of nowhere and a credit with Lance and Jennifer in them. So that was a big deal. And my dream was to be on Saturday Night Live. And I wanted to be repped by Rhonda Price at Gersh. And I wanted to be on SNL for like 5 to 6 years, you know, stay too long.
Yeah. You had the whole thing where you're just like, look, if I don't want to outstay my welcome, I kind of want to leave them wanting a little bit more.
leave a little food on the table.
What leave movies are going to be calling? And their movie based on this golf caddy character I've been working on is obviously going to get like 100 million the first weekend. And
obviously, no, I really dreamt of being the next Rob Reiner. So the dream was SNL. And then I thought, how could I do what Rob did where you make Spinal Tap? I think Spinal Tap is 84. Then it went Princess Bride, Stand By Me, Harry Met Sally, Misery, A Few Good Men, American President. I was like, can I try to do what that dude does where you jump around genres and make dope movies? And that was the dream. I didn't know I'd get to work with Spike Lee and Clint Eastwood. That was very like weird spiritual nepotism. I felt like God threw that shit in my lap and it was my job not to screw it up. That is about it.
How intensive was the path to becoming, to getting cast as Richard Jewell?
It was, I didn't do anything. That's the, when people want to give me credit, I always feel like guilty, like I'm lying. Cause I was sober while shooting The Five Bloods, Spike's movie in Thailand. I was alone. I didn't have an assistant. I didn't bring a buddy. I didn't bring a girlfriend, nothing. And I was miserable, not on the movie, because I love making movies. I love Spike, but I was alone in a foreign country and the air pollution. They're like, go outside and wear a mask. Careful, you might get robbed. Careful, you might get sick from street food. I just was like this weird sheltered kid who like wasn't traveled and wasn't enjoying myself in Thailand. And I get a phone call one night that says, hey, you've been offered the lead in a miniseries to play Richard Jewell. And it was the most lucrative thing I'd ever been offered. It was insane. It was, I wouldn't have even asked for what they offered. No, like,
what would they have seen that they would have made that offer from? Would have been?
Probably a combo of Itania, Black Klansman, my show Kingdom, which was underseen, but I'd like did my thing in it. And so I think some combo of those roles. And, and they offered it to me 3 days later. Because the agents are doing the agent thing where they're like, we're going to get you more money. And I'm like, can you not screw up my life? I'm fine. Yeah. Don't lose the job. Yeah. And while they're doing that, 3 days later, I get a phone call that says Clint Eastwood wants you to star in his new movie. And I was like, probably not. And they're like, no, they do. It's Richard Jewell. And I go, are you telling me I've been offered the same character in opposing roles within 72 hours? Is that what the fuck you're telling me? And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. And at the end of the day, what was really tough, Tom, was the fact that I had to sit in my bed at 4 a.m. in my underpants, having not slept, on a call with agents who are 14 hours behind me in LA. And they're like, you have to make a decision. They're getting pissed. They're not going to wait any longer. We can't give you an offer on the Clint Eastwood Richard Jewell. It's just a verbal offer. There's no paperwork.
Wow. Okay.
There's paperwork and a high six figures if you want to do the TV show instead. So I like just said to them, I'm like, yo, the Bible talks about you can operate out of fear or love. The two can't really abide. And I was like, fear would tell me to take the money. Love would tell me to work with Clint Eastwood. Tell him I'm going to work with Eastwood.
Cool.
So they were all like, rah, rah, sis, kum, bah. I was like ready to put a gun to my head. And it just so happens it turned out well. The movie didn't make as much money. It didn't. It wasn't like it won Best Picture, but I had a great opportunity. I think I seized it and I learned a lot. Like I learned a lot working with all those people. And I learned about myself where like I did stand up for 12 years. A lot of people don't know that. I did stand up in front of 2,000 people. I opened for Dave Attell and Pauly Shore and stuff. And like,
really?
Like back when I was 19, I opened for them on a college show in front of like 2,000 people. It was terrifying. But like, I could do that. But driving to set with, driving to set in the morning to go to Richard Jewell, I literally would be blaring Kendrick Lamar, beating my chest till it was red and drinking cold brew. Because I had to convince myself I was worthy of the task, the opportunity. And so when I showed up, it was kind of me being this elevated, not fake version of me, but kind of, I got to like put something on because it's really scary. You don't want to fuck a $40 million Warner Brothers movie based on a dude who died. Like it's not a good look. So,
but you also were probably able to channel that vulnerability and desire to do good.
It was tough because Richard Jewell was kind of he wasn't like what people consider cool, and I'm just like, I'm so cool.
he's biting into a chicken leg while he's saying that, just so you guys know.
How do I play Richard Jewell when I'm like you know what I'm like? I'm like if Adam Levine. I'm like if Adam Levine was like fat and didn't dress cool.
So you
wait, I just want to ask one more question about Richard Jewell. That scene in the boardroom with the lawyers at the end, did you do a couple takes where you cried? Because there's such an emotional power to him finally standing up for himself that I just remember like feeling anxious, not anxious for him, but just like just saying like, get out what you need to say right now. Right now is your chance. That scene is so great. And I just wanted to know what it was like to shoot it. And if you had other takes where you felt like you broke or you like, just like straddling that line between like, I'm standing up for myself, but also like, I feel like I'm going to break down.
I mean, that's a pretty universal human emotion. Like in general, like forget FBI high stakes, like who hasn't been in a room with someone who they know doesn't like them and felt kind of undermined and maybe.
That's how Brett feels right now.
I mean, Brett, your adorable little detached goatee. You look like if the mountain man came back to the city and goes, yeah, I guess I'll mingle with you people. I guess I'll.
Oh, wow. I'm living right now. I'm living.
That's it. That's all we're going to talk about. Brett,
never though. Made him happier. Look at him. He just had a baby. He just had a baby and like he didn't give a shit compared to how happy he is right now.
Congratulations on having a baby and wearing the hell out of that crimson shirt, bud.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Thank you. Oh, my God. I'm feasting right now.
We've never seen him happier.
To just sum it up, I thought that scene, even though elevated, was pretty universal emotionally. And the day I had to shoot it, two of my agents from CAA showed up. And I was like, of course they show up today and not the day where I'm doing two lines. Well, you know. So anyway, I do it and there's added pressure, but I'm kind of in the zone and I'm listening. I'm probably listening to the National, you know, in my earbuds and getting all white boy weepy. Mm-hmm. And I get into the room and do it. And we did a wide, we started on a wide shot and it was the best take I did out of any of them.
Wow!
But it sucked because it was in a wide. You're not going to play that in a wide shot. So the second I did it, Clint didn't yell cut. And they go, boss, do you want to cut? And he goes, that was perfect. And they just kind of looked down like he almost looked defeated, but inspired. I didn't know how to read him. And then he punched in and they moved in. And I probably got about four takes of the punched in version. And I didn't cry in any of them. I just kind of stayed in that place because I knew that the diner scene at the end of the movie where I eat that donut, I had planned probably 2 weeks in. I was like, I think I'm going to take a bite of the donut and let the character feel his freedom a little bit. Mm-hmm. And the sweetness and the sugar of the donut. And that's kind of who he is as a guy, like getting to digest a bite of donut is going to be weirdly profound and be the catalyst to make me cry in the moment. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to cry in the boardroom because I knew I was going to do it in the diner. And Rockwell kind of made fun of it and was like, you know, don't call it Hauser. Don't call it the crying scene. Don't make it about the crying. It's not about that. It's about, you know, but on the day we did it and I was really happy with how it turned out. And I asked for more takes. Clint's very notorious for one or two, but there were three scenes in the movie that I told Clint, I said, dude, I love you. I know you have a process and you're the man. Everybody knows that. But you've allowed me to star in your $40 million biopic. You need to let me do a couple more of these because it's about making your movie good. It's not about ego. It's not about fear. It's about trying to give you what you need. And very gracefully, I think two out of the three times, maybe even all three, I think he let us do like an extra two takes. So that was cool.
Yeah, he's got a whole system down, huh? With the same, working with the same crew and the same, yeah, everything's like a machine.
And it's a great machine, but my whole thing is like, I, how do I say this? I want to be respectful, but I also want to be me, which is tough sometimes. I don't care about legacy to the degree that I'm going to lie to someone's face. If something's not great, I would want to be told when I'm not great, and people have often. So why can't I elicit the same thing and have that sort of transactional reciprocity? So like I sat down with David Mamet once, who offered me his Fatty Arbuckle movie that he wrote for Chris Farley. I was honored that he even knew who I was, let alone bought my chicken parm or whatever. So we're sitting down and he notoriously doesn't allow improv. In fact, he likes to dictate the diction and the delivery of his actors.
Yeah, like he basically writes in line readings.
Oh, yeah. And once again, process, it's worked. I like the verdict. I like Glengarry Glen Ross. I get it. But I said to him, I go, if we're going to do this, I have to be able to improvise and kind of do my own thing. And and a couple of my actor friends were like, you said that to Mamet? And I'm like, it's not about saying it to Mamet. It's about doing a really good job for Mamet. And if somebody's ego gets in the way of what we're trying to accomplish, it's going to be a shitty product anyway.
Yeah, that's a good, you're actually, you've got some, it's some big picture thinking you're trying to do on these things. And not just, it's not just, that's not as ego driven in its own way, actually, because you're being respectful of the larger goal.
Right. And we all have ego. It's okay to admit that. It's like prejudice. You know, we're not all racist, but we do all have prejudice born in us, unfortunately. And I think it's okay to, you know, have those discussions. And you know what? The people who don't want to have the discussions are the ones where you go, oh, this might be a never meet your heroes scenario. Maybe I like you in a theater, but not in the same room for 3 months, you know, and that's okay too.
Oh, absolutely. There are friends that I know, Julie, I would think you would feel the same way. There's certain people where you're like, it's probably better that we've always been friends and not worked together, right? Because it would just change the dynamic. But I can say this, Paul, and to everybody listening, I have worked with Julie, and we want to talk about difficult people. She wrote every one of those, almost 98% of those jokes were from Julie's brain. I'm going to say 98%. I was there for pretty much.
Except on for the all. Ones I got in trouble for. Those were somebody else.
Yeah. Somebody else did those too. Those awful 2% that got you in trouble. No, but
bastard.
Seriously, I'm going to say this. I'm not here to promote you, Julie. I'm not here. But you know what? Paul mentioned difficult people. And I've just got to say, I was there. You want to? I said it before. I'll say it again. Line by line, there's no funnier writer in show business than Julie Klausner.
Oh, hey. Well, high praise, Paul, coming from a high praised man.
I saw it with my own eyes.
I thank you, and scripts I hope coming, to write one's something worse for than you, the Paul. Next.
These scripts are coming in just as an embarrassment, and then Julie's like, "Give me this. Watch what I do." And it comes back, and it's a font of greatness.
Yeah, I would love to weasel in and work with Julie. I think
nothing would make me happier than to write for you, Paul. To quote, I think you should leave. Give me that. Give me that.
To quote, I think you should leave. I gotta go.
How did you get? How did you get in with Tim?
We need to talk about. I think you should leave, and that bastard Jamie Taco, and you getting in that line. You said jabronis like 7 times in that line. Yeah.
That is, okay, so here's how I got this show.
Because Tim is the alt, like Tim that's a Hall of Fame funny. So,
and I was watching Dr. Strangelove and I was watching George C. Scott, and I thought Tim Robinson should be playing George C. Scott in something.
Gosh. I haven't seen George Dr. Strangelove since high school.
He is so funny in that movie, and I thought, who's as funny as this guy? It's on the tip of my tongue. Oh, that's right. Tim motherfucking Robinson.
Here's the thing about Tim. I want to point this out. Do any of you have siblings?
Yeah, we both do.
So I have 3 siblings. We don't agree on everything, but one thing that is like steroidally agreed upon is our shared sense of humor. and how born in us it is. It's kind of so cement. It's like cement on cement, but it's the kind of thing where we have this weird humor where like we'd be in church on a Sunday growing up and some woman would walk up really stoically to like read a Bible verse in front of the church. And we'd be whispering to each other, like we just say fucked up stuff to each other that would make each other laugh. Like she just starts talking. What if she gets up there and just starts talking about her divorce? Or we'd be like, what if she got up there and just lit up a joint? Like it was always a what if scenario joke, but we did it ad nauseum and we still do it. And sometimes it's like, grab your body. Like you're literally in pain laughing. And for some reason, I don't know what it is, but Tim Robinson's humor feels like weird inside joke, personalized humor. It's like the difference between a Michelin chef and Red Lobster. Now I like Red Lobster and I can eat some Cheddar Bay biscuits like I'm stoned and on an island somewhere. But the Michelin chef, there are going to be people that go to Red Lobster and then they taste the Michelin chef and go, the hell is this? Why is it this big? I hate this. That's Tim Robinson, though. He's that funny and that good that if you get it, you'll say that was the best meal I ever had, even though I can't pronounce it. And everybody else is like, well, I have clam strips and they're unlimited.
It is inside joke funny. You're completely right. That's the joke that makes you laugh the hardest is the one that would take too long to explain to someone.
Well, you can't explain it. And that's what makes it great. You also can't explain some of the shit you eat at a really nice restaurant, but it's dope, you know?
So tell us how that came about. Did he just come to you with the sketch already? It was completely written. Because
you're both Michigan guys then.
We never met in Michigan. I'm like starting sentences and then fragmenting out.
You're doing great.
It's a combination of poor sleep and years of marijuana ingesting. I met Tim Robinson at Seth Meyers' Golden Globes party. Him and Sam were wasted. And I went up and said hi to them and talked to them. And I was always a fan of him and thought he was funny. My buddy Tim Baltz, I think, worked with him at Second City. And I had heard stories about how funny and crazy he was. But then I watched the show. I had a bunch of my guy friends from high school come visit me on Richard Jewell. I said, come to Atlanta. I'll get us an Airbnb with like a pool and I'll stock the fridge full of booze and food and we'll have a lot of fun. So like I treated my guy friends this weekend. And we just binge watched I Think You Should Leave season one summer of 2019 and cried laughing. And we're like, this is insane. And then I IMDb Tim, which I do all the time. I'm like such an IMDb nerd. I'm a weirdo like that. And I IMDb Tim Robinson and we have the same agent. So I immediately emailed my agent that fall. It's probably like October, November, 2019. I said, I'll come serve lunch. Like just
give me that. Give me that.
Give me that. Mm-hmm. And she put me in an email with him and they sent me two scripts. They sent me the one I did. And then they sent me the one with the guy in the courtroom with the hat.
Oh my God.
And they said, choose one or the other. They're letting you choose. And I said, I could tell they were both written like with Tim in mind. So it was such an honor to do it. But I just thought the one with the wife was just so funny because it takes such a sharp, endless detour. And that's how all my humor is. It's always like detour laced and really tangential and stupid.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you were in that one because your relationship with the actress who played your wife is so convincing.
She was so sweet. She was so good. Her name was Jen Marsala. She's married in real life, I believe, to a TV writer or somebody who works in her industry, but she was so good. She was perfect.
That scene when she's talking to you through the mirror and she said it was the best line in the show is like genuinely touching.
I was actually crying during that. I had to whip up tears in that scene because my whole approach to it, like I did that show Kimmy Schmidt. I'm sure you guys are friends with a bunch of those folks. And I play this character Trip Knob, and that's like that's like athletic comedy where you have to like really lean in. This was kind of me just playing it straight like it was a drama and allowing it to be funny because of the sincerity. Mm-hmm. So that was the approach with that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really
inside the actor's studio. Some people talk about like, there I was with Julianne Moore and we're both covered in blood. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, so there I was doing a sketch for $1,000.
And Jamie Taco kept stealing my lines.
Jamie Taco. Another Tim Robbins.
Son of a bitch. What a jabroni.
What a jabroni.
Who's the first heavyweight when you were just on set and you looked at that person, you're just like, how on earth am I going to go toe to toe with this person?
And as an addendum, were you able to just forget that Kathy Bates was Kathy Bates and just be like, this is my mom and I love her?
So two things to answer Tom's question. The first movie I did, the Lance Black movie.
Okay.
I worked with Jennifer Connelly my first week or week and a half on the movie. And there was a night shoot where she had a fever of like 102. And I think she was missing her family and her kids. And she was kind of having a rough go of it, but she was delivering like A+ work every take. And it's like midnight. That was a big moment for me to just be like, oh, this is what it's like to work with someone of that ilk.
Yeah. You see, they've got a different gear,
different amount of preparation, a healthy amount of fearlessness, you know? But she was something to marvel at. And then Ed Harris was so intimidating. The guy's like 160 pounds soaking wet, but you feel like he could beat up a dinosaur.
That is so crazy. Cause in my mind, I only think of him as being like you said, he's huge in my mind.
Yeah, he could kill you with his bare hands.
Oh yeah. Or with a look, you know, and that's, that's kind of what the really great actors have. I think it was who's the guy who just died who I loved? He was in Knives Out, old guy.
Christopher Plummer
said all the great actors have great rage, not range, rage, R-A-G-E. And I think Ed's one of those guys. So he really was, my first couple takes with Ed Harris, I was just watching him. I wasn't even acting. And then I had to like smelling salt myself and go, you're being paid to act, dumbass. Like, stop watching him. But with Kathy, I suggested Kathy in the room to Clint the first day we met. They wouldn't tell me any of the casting choices. And I said to him, I go, man, I feel like Kathy Bates has to play the mom. And he smiled and everybody in the room kind of smiled and nodded. And they go, we'll see. Clearly they had an offer out to, her. They might've talked to Frances McDormand. I don't remember, but to me, it was always Kathy. I didn't even think twice. I was like, she has to be the mom. And then one day I wake up and they send me an email and they're like, yeah, Kathy's your mom.
And when you met her, were you immediately like, just like, was there like a familial kind of intimacy right away, or did it have to kind of build?
I'm a huggy, lovey guy in general. I'm pretty embraced. Like, I'm pretty immediately embracing of like everybody. So I was just wrapped her up in my arms, gave her a hug. She whispered in my ear and said, you were so good in I, Tonya. I'm so glad you're the guy. And I was like, dude, I'm not going to list your whole resume, but you know what you mean to people like me. And we did a little meeting and we had a drink. I like left the night I met John Hamm and no, I had met John before. Who did I meet? I met Kathy and a couple other folks. And I went out into the hotel bar feeling like really like, holy shit, it's real. And I order a shot of scotch, like a single or a double. And I ordered yeah, give me the 25 year Macallan or whatever. Not even thinking. They give me the shot and it's $400. And they had already poured it. I wanted to give it back and they had already poured it. And I felt like an idiot. So I literally, this is pre-COVID. I just passed it around and me, Clint's producer, John Hamm, Kathy, we're all just like sipping this one shot. It was so funny.
That's amazing. Yeah. Those are great moments where you're just like,
surreal.
I remember when I was like, when I didn't have any money at all. And I would hang out with people who did have money. And then we'd be at a restaurant and be like, should we just split the thing? And I'd be like, I had a Diet Coke because I don't have any money. You all ate full meals and had multiple drinks. I expressly had a soda, so I didn't have to do.
That's when I toss a $10 bill on the table.
Yeah.
And I run out of the restaurant.
Well, 140 each.
I literally grab my phone. I go, guys, my dad died. I was backwards out of the restaurant. It's tough.
Can we talk about Cruella for a second?
I love that movie,
I saw it twice in the theater.
Yeah.
Tom saw it in the theater, he was blown away.
I saw it in the theater. I was just like, well, I want to go back to the movies. What's happening? It's just like, I guess we'll try Cruella, see what that is. And then I was like, oh my God, this is literally like Goodfellas for children.
For girls, too, like little girls having like fashion sequences instead of action sequences.
But the level of.
But there are action sequences constant, in it, too. But just like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the constant like pushing and the inventiveness and the energy and the spirit of it. I was like, I can't believe this is just like I feel like this is going to be one that I'm going to have to tell people who are like. No, Cruella, you have to see Cruella. They're like,
You have to see it. It's on Disney Plus right now. It's on Disney Plus right now for free if you have Disney Plus. You have to see Cruella.
It is.
Tom was like, this is Goodfellas. I said, okie dokie. I ended up seeing twice in the theater. I loved it so much.
Yeah.
You know what, too, though? People forget that movie's made by the same guy who freaking... We have one of the writers from The Favorite. Mm-hmm. Like, what?
Yeah,
that's like one of the hippest, weirdest, almost like Kubrick adjacent movies of the last 20 years.
Yep.
Like a Disney movie has one of the writers from The Favorite, the movie with the bunny rabbits and everybody's getting fingered every 9 minutes. Like that's insane. And then you add on to that the fact that Craig Gillespie did Lars and the Real Girl and I, Tonya. And it's like, you're going to get a dope movie.
Did you work with a dialect coach?
Yeah, I worked with a dialect coach named Neil Swain out of London, and he really helped. But I was told to audition because Disney wanted to make sure they were ready to cast a British guy. Okay. Disney didn't want me. Disney didn't want me at all. Craig Gillespie wanted me. Emma Stone wanted me. So we had to convince Disney. I basically just watched Hook and just kept doing that thing of there's a line in Hook that I've keep in mind. I was born in 86. So I saw Hook when I was like 5 or something. I've been quoting this line for 25, 30 years or whatever. Of he's Peter Pan, all right. He's just been gone from Neverland so long. He's forgotten everything. I've been saying that for 30 years or whatever it's been. So I just literally aped that from Bob Hoskins and tried to copy and paste the choices into the vocality. And goof around in the office, and I got the part, and Disney was happy. But when I flew to London immediately, I met with a dialect coach who brought it from like a D plus to like a B plus.
Let's explain to Paul what we want him to do before we let him we leave him to the rest of his day.
Paul, if you enjoyed the writing of a Julie Klausner.
No, boy, don't you dare. Boy. No, don't you. No, 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 no. Tom, I swear to God, we wrote this together. How dare you?
No, but you're the vision. You're the vision. You are.
Of course.
You,
always. The muse.
Look.
Not the Albert Brooks movie.
No, Tom, you wrote for Monk. That was like one of the best shows before TV got really good.
He wrote for every
season.
Yeah, it was
back. I wrote for every season back when TV was bad.
That was amazing.
Right before TV got good.
It was me being a dick. Making a
It was the Jeffersons. It was the Jeffersons. It was,
and then there was like all those spinoffs of the Beverly Hillbillies, Petticoat Junction, Green Acres.
And then one day, Tony Soprano walked in the room and said, "No more.
I'll take it from here."
And then Cynthia Nixon walked in and said, "Sex and the City."
He said,
"Yeah."
He just disappeared. Paul just disappeared from the frame.
Nobody's doing better Zoom outs.
Zoom work. He's throwing up.
Yeah.
So, okay. So this is very hard to explain, but Tom and I once got an email from Brett saying that this guy had left Forever Dog and his name was Gary. And we really don't know anything about who Gary was, but we assume that he was a British gangster.
We get this email.
Right.
where it's just like, hey, everyone, it's Gary. I just want to thank you all for years of working together here.
It was Brett saying, I regret to announce the loss of a tremendous member of Forever Dog, like a founding member of Forever, which is the podcast network we're on.
Our former CEO.
Then I get an email five seconds after the email from Brett comes with like eulogizing this great Gary that apparently we've been working with for a year and a half now. I get an email from, I'm reading it and I say to myself, who the fuck is Gary? And then I get an email 30 seconds later from Julie and all it says in it is, who the fuck is Gary? So we were on the same page. Like, apparently we were working with some guy named Gary for the last year and a half.
So we have a theory that he's been roughing up other podcast networks. And that he sounds like Michael Caine or Ray Winstone.
Yeah.
And we want you to audition for the role. Well, actually, no, you've got the role. We want you to record a monologue that we wrote as Gary that we can use to threaten other podcast networks if need be.
Listen.
It's a long walk.
It's not a short order.
Paul, you don't really need to understand this inside joke. Please read the script as a British gangster.
Let's do the monologue.
So, Brett, do you have a script for Paul?
Yes. Yeah. Pulling it up right now.
Okay. Give me 2 seconds. I just want to take a sip of this LaCroix.
No, we're going to watch this. Julie.
Yeah. What?
Julie, watch the process. We're about to watch it.
Should we get rid of that last, Tom, just quick writer's sake. Should we get rid of that last paragraph?
No. Don't lose it.
Let's get it. He's going to let us.
But you can always edit it. You can always edit it.
Here we go.
All right. Okay.
This is going to be a masterclass right now in performance.
All right, everybody watch.
All right. Oh, Gary's the name. Gary from Forever Dog. I couldn't help but notice that you got a right nice podcast studio here at Earwolf. What's that? Colin Anderson. Yeah. There's the equipment, mic stands, water bottles, wooden tables with comedians' names sharpied on them, yeah. It'd be an awful shame if something happened to him. No, I don't know, somebody could take a match to these knocked wooden tables. Wouldn't that be terrible? Coming to work one day, seeing a big pile of ash. I certainly not find that very nice. So, what do you say to handing over all your cash to Tom and Julie? They take Venmo. I know they'd appreciate it. I know that if they don't get that generous contribution, they might get angry. And if they get angry, I get angry. And I'm not a bloke who's got a particularly healthy relationship with my temperament. You catch my meaning, yeah? Thank you for your time. Hey, you mind if I help myself with that nice watch you're wearing? Good man. I think I've got just the wrist for that. That's all I got.
Oh, that was a true masterclass. And I'm not sure what, but it was a masterclass. Now that was, Paul, that was transcendently great.
It was well written. Thank you.
Oh my God.
This is the best day of my life.
No. So when you've done a fair amount of real life people, and what does that take for you to play somebody who was an actual person, not a character created wholly from fiction? What responsibilities or burdens does that present to you?
It depends on the genre, because as they say, dying is easy, comedy's hard. I hate when people talk like that. Comedy's easy if you're funny. I don't know why people say that line all the time. Do you feel like comedy's hard, Tom and Julie? Because you're both very funny. No. But I don't think it's actually hard for you, is it?
It's not.
No, it's like breathing if you're funny. But I've never heard that expression. That sounds like coming from someone with no sense of humor is insufferable.
Well, it's just a Hollywood thing. In every roundtable interview, they bring it up and they go, there's an old expression. And I'm like, ugh. I think comedy's easy as shit.
Some windbag said this once.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, they keep repeating it. And I kind of laugh at it because I think drama is exponentially harder. I think showing up and having to do some accent and relay genuine emotions and having to think the thoughts that elicit the emotions. Because if you don't think it's just like high school theater. We've all done that acting where you say a line, I'm waiting for you to finish so I can say a line. And then when I'm done, you can say a line. I mean, good dramatic acting, I think, is pretty tough. But it also depends how close the person is to you. So, you know, playing Black Klansman, I played a guy who was a composite of all these racist dudes in Colorado back in the day. And that wasn't fun. I had to show up and kind of, you know, I did something where I did an underbite and I put caffeine packets in my bottom lip to look like tobacco. I had a posture where I bent over a little bit and kind of swiveled my head back and forth and smiled and had a certain laugh. And then I would improvise racist stuff because Spike liked my improv and I was in character and I would just go off if he let me. And like, that's not fun to do. That's not great. It's fun to be creative. It's not fun to play that guy. And Richard Jewell, that's a little more fun because he's not a scary racist, but you're trying to honor, you're trying to honor someone's life. It's a different thing with commitment. Now, if you put me in a Duplass movie and you're like, hey, Paul and Mark Duplass play best friends and they're married to Melanie Lynskey and Chloe Savini, and you're going to improvise half your dialogue and you're playing a version of yourself, that would not be as taxing. I can do that drama a little more fluidly because I'll be playing a version of myself. But when you got to put the person on, that is kind of a taxing, weird thing. You know?
Sure, because the Richard Jewell thing is in it and in and of itself a tricky thing because, I mean, the culture looked at him as a bit of a punchline at points because he was just an obvious, he could fit the role for that. Walking away, where just like for that guy to show up in the middle of that and be overwhelmed by the entirety and the moment, easy thing to just read in the culture as like a buffoon or just somebody who you could look down upon.
You know what's really sad, Tom? I love that you said what you just said because I get a little too much credit sometimes where people watch me and they're like, man, in somebody else's hands, that could have been such a doofus idiot character, but I cared about him. Here's the reality. And this is kind of poking a pin in my own balloon, but I don't care that much. If we actually didn't judge people the way we do based on headlines and momentary infractions and just contextual clues that we assume are concrete character, if we didn't do that and we actually got to know certain people that we momentarily despised, we'd probably humanize them and look at them the same way you looked at me after 2 hours of Richard Jewell. The only reason it feels like, whoa, he's three-dimensional, it's because he sat with it for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. But we don't live in a culture that wants to afford that amount of grace or take that amount of patience. So it feels like a bit of a magic trick and look at me, but the reality is I would hope anyone would feel a modicum or a measure of feeling for someone, even if they seemed like they wouldn't be the best person.
And then did the family of Richard Jewell, were they happy with how you did, or have you heard anything, or were they supportive? Or
his mom, who I've met a few times, his mother, Bobby Jewell, and his eternal friend and attorney, Watson Bryant, they said something to the effect, and I don't remember verbatim, but they said they watched the movie privately, I think, maybe at Warner Brothers or something, I don't remember. But they watched the movie without an audience, just the two or three of them. And they said it felt like they had Richard back for 2 hours. Wow. So, you know, the tomato meters and the award seasons can say what they want. I don't think I get a better meaningful compliment than that. You know, that's all.
No, wonderful.
It really did strike such an amazing tone because it's like you could have, there were points where you could not laugh, not like you're roaring in the aisles, but you're getting the spirit of this guy that he's a you know, kind of outskirts of what people, you know, might perceive to be like that kind of guy who'd be the face of being a security law enforcement guy. Yeah, exactly.
Too. Yeah. Right.
So, I mean, he's clearly never going to fit the role with that, but you can have fun with that and understand who that guy is, but it was never ultimately, played with any sort of I thought you brought such a depth to it and a caring to it that you could have fun with him without feeling like you're
like he was down on him.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're not punching down. I mean, I think it's a good illustration, but the movie portrays somebody pretty nakedly and honestly, from what I can tell, we tried to. And at the end of the day, there are going to be things you like and don't like. You know, it's so weird. The older I get, like, I just feel like, I feel like all of my prior judgment of people is just kind of being whittled down and diluted into just realizing how similar we all are and that we all want the same stuff. It just, we all want all the same shit. We just have different packaging and bows and wrapping paper, you know? And now the only type of person I really get annoyed by in culture is the people who aren't willing to be educated and are just kind of mean-spirited as like a hobby. Because like difficult people, you watch it and like sometimes they say mean stuff or they make fun of people or they're catty and petty about little things. But like it's Seinfeldian. It's not like we're saying these are perfect people. We're saying they're flawed people who then also make a little friend game out of pointing out the flaws in others. And it's equal parts like super funny and kind of endearing. And just like, really, you're going to make fun of the toaster strudel and you're the Pop-Tart. Like,
you know,
it's that stuff.
And we loved each other.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, you know, that's the way to approach that stuff, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, I have spent hours watching you and loving you, just like you were saying, the affection you feel for Richard Jewell in that movie and the affection that I feel for characters that you've played. I just have fallen in love with you, and having spent time with you as a real person, I've just spent an hour with you and I love you even more.
Absolutely. Hey,
love you guys. You guys made me feel really cool. And, you know, it's one thing to get asked to do a podcast and it can be fun, but like, you're really accomplished people who have made me laugh and made me happy in the past too. So it means a lot.
Thank you. And Paul, just so you know, this Inside the Actor Studio stuff, you're just getting started. So we're so excited to see you at the very beginning of you know, whatever is next. You're the real deal. And we're so excited to just have spent this time with you. So thank you again so much.
Let me tell you, seriously. When I come to New York, you two better not like forget to look at your cell phones, because I'm going to be hitting you up. We're going to grab a slice of New York's finest. Uh-huh. We're going to fold it, because that's what you do. Mm-hmm. Right?
Thank you.
We're going to fold it, and we're gonna eat our little heart's desire. Gluten-free, gluten-plus, whatever.
Sounds like a plan.
All right. Oh,
thank you so much.
Thank you again,
Paul.
Paul.
What a treat.
Can we use that monologue or parts of it to open every show? Can we just replace, not no disrespect to the great Mike Kroll, but can we possibly replace our theme song with him?
Can we replace? I'd be willing to replace me with that.
Yeah, let's rip. This is the show from now on. If we just do that recording.
That was probably enough to like run it through a bot and just kind of create. We could just sort of create an endless.
Why don't
you
do a soundboard so that you're more like Baba Booey?
Okay. Yeah, I've always wanted to do a soundboard for Double Threat. I wasn't sure if that was something you guys would be into,
Tom,
or not. But
what do you think of that idea? Should we give Brett that power to have a soundboard?
I don't know.
Then we'll discuss it. Although build
on a provisional basis, maybe
giving
just
him
try
permission
it out
to build it is almost like saying to North Korea, like, okay, build the nuclear bomb, and then we'll have a conversation.
Yeah, I got to think about whether I want Brett with a full soundboard on this show.
I was thinking just like doing the Foley live too, you know, not going to it like a, you know,
I forget
straight,
I ever
you know,
mentioned okay. it, you know, but why? I do think
Julie, we're going to end up talking, and then suddenly you'll say, I went and got two veggie dogs down on the street. Then suddenly be like, oh, behave. Like that's what's going to happen. We give this guy a soundboard. Yeah, baby.
You've only pitched to improve the show.
Here, you start saying something and I'll show you what it'll be like with Brett's soundboard.
So I am going to meet my friend Shane.
Yeah, baby.
That's the same thing.
Just keep,
you're saying he only
keep
has
going.
That
Just
one.
Keep going.
Okay. And then tomorrow, I think I'm actually going to go out to Washington Heights.
Turn it off. Turn it off. Turn it off. Do you like that?
Oh my god. I don't not like
that. Seems
it.
Fun.
Mm-hmm. Brett, what's your home address? Do you want to say it on the show?
Yeah, sure.
Actually, I need to send you
is
something.
Is this a soundboard thing?
No, I need to mail you what something. I'm just remembering it now.
I'm just saying that it would be funny if one of the things in the soundboard is Brett's full address.
Yeah. Speaking of my home, it's 231 Ambassador Lane, Los Tom. Angeles, California.
Oh, no.
90046.
Yeah. Come on by. Meet the baby. The worst nightmare.
Hey, Brad. Hello, Brad.
So it seems like we accidentally doxed Brett.
Yeah.
Brad, I brought them fish. I got a fish bachelor.
Actually, you know what, though, Tom? You're presenting him. You're presenting Brett with, like, this fantasy. Like, if he had a reality show, yeah, so people far, so bring... Yeah. I was going to say, people bring him a fresh fish, and he gets to decide what, however he, like, rubs or glazes yeah. it.
He'd tell that guy, come on in. Let's get cooked.
All need to... The price of admission is one fresh so fish. Sounds great.
Yeah, exactly. So far this is great.
I brought some fish. And I got a new fish bachelor for you.
Oh,
extra
great.
Extra long.
Yeah, take a seat.
Have you been using your fish spatula a lot this week?
I have. Yeah, I found some other uses for it besides fish, too. It worked well in some banana pancakes this week. Fish spatula is merely a sort of, a one thing that it can be used for.
And the banana pancakes did not taste like fish.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Please, I hope you're scrubbing that spatula thoroughly before you go. I don't want to go over your house and have banana pancakes and be just like, this tastes like salmon.
There was a hint of halibut in the banana pancakes, but I think it enhanced it, because they were a little too sweet. Yeah. And the halibut residue really,
all this talk, really, all I picture now is Amy in a McDonald's parking lot just eating before she goes home fat, like just eating a burger real fast. She's like, I can't. He's making these pancakes and they taste like fish now, and he's telling me that's a good thing. It's not so hot right now over at the in the kitchen. And then he's singing songs.
Baby food is, yeah. Oh gosh.
He's rhyming glaze with glaze.
and what was the other one? Beast and things.
Yeah, we're gonna get Brett a rhyming dictionary.
I didn't say I didn't love it.
Oh, I loved it. I heard the 15 seconds I heard was the best thing I've heard all year.
And to hear the second half, just skip back one episode in the feed. Mm-hmm. It's right there waiting for you.
Don't plug the weird bonus episode you did without our permission.
Yeah.
I also have a great anecdote about the Barbara Streisand movie, The Mirror Has Two Faces, that you're not going to want to miss.
Oh, yeah, that was fun.
Papa, can you hear me? Papa.
Papa, watch me flip. And then he flips the fish.
Yeah, exactly. He'll just be like, Mahi, Mahi, can you hear me?
Mahi, can you Mahi? Yeah.
As he just pours glaze over his own head.
Lights myself on fire and
that's one of me, like, if you had to choose a way to die,
yeah,
would in that a be vat
of his own glaze?
Oh yeah, die, like a sort of a brandy glaze, something with a little bit of alcohol in it, and then just light a match and bon voyage.
Oh my god,
going off to that big yeah, glazery
in the sky,
that
big chili cook off in the sky.
When is Turlingua?
November 6th.
Okay, you got your ticket
coming up.
I got my Airbnb. I haven't got my plane ticket yet because I'm kind of figuring out how to get there, because Turlingua is very much in the middle of nowhere.
Well, Julie's driving,
Oh, fantastic. Well, that solves that.
No, maybe she could pick you up at the Austin airport.
I've never agreed to this.
Would you drive to San Antonio and pick Brett up?
No.
You're not going to be there holding a sign for him? when he comes off the plane? As a, like,
I'll be holding a sign, all right.
What if you put on like a chauffeur cap and then you like hold up a sign as if like you like work for a car service? It just says like,
get in, loser.
Brett. It just says, Brett, get in, loser. And he's like, he's coming off and then he's like, yeah, I checked a whole lot of bags. It's going to take a while. I checked some bags.
It's like bags are like clanging on the.
Yeah.
It's like clanging with pots and pans.
Yeah, and sloshing.
Stand up base.
Clanging
comes
and
down.
Slot. You bring your own marinade on the friggin'.
You're waiting at the carousel. A stand up base comes rolling down. And Brett goes, that's mine.
Like
a stand up base.
Him like forgetting that you can't take liquids on the plane and like crying as he's pouring out a bottle of his own glaze.
Like, yeah, these suitcases got to go then.
In front of the TSA lady, like sobbing.
Yeah. He's pouring out his own glaze into the can, tears. And then he says, well, you can't, if I wear the glaze, then you can't do it.
The second he gets into my car, he starts aggressively like squeezing the liquid out of his hair into the ashtray of this rental car.
Yeah.
He's like, don't touch it.
You pull back into Enterprise. They're like, hey, can we just ask you a question? What's all this? Why is the car so sticky?
Why are they soaked with, like, want to say orange juice? And then Brett gets really mad. Yeah. He's like, kumquats!
Hey, the car's infested with ants.
He's like, those ain't mine.
Yeah. Wow, what a total treat. Paul Walter Hauser. Unbelievable.
The best. The best of the best. And if we were playing, what's that called? Fantasy football or something. Yeah, tic-tac-toe. I would invest all my stocks in this guy.
Oh my God, are you kidding? That's a stock on the rise. Because, Julie, at some point,
en route to greatness.
He's gonna win.
Is it?
Some point
is
he's going to win an Oscar.
He'll never remember us.
He's going to win an Oscar, and we're going to be like, "Well, we had him on Double Threat. We had an Oscar winner on Double Threat."
Yeah, and then we'll kill ourselves.
Yeah, then we'll kill ourselves. The final episode.
I got a great way to do
it. Yeah, Brett's plan.
Thanks, Brett.
Now, yes, and thank you to everybody who listened.
And rate and review and subscribe and harass us on social media and send us fan art, please.
And go to the merch store over at tpublic.com/something else.
It's in the
slash shirts
stores
slash stores.
Yeah,
.com. tpublic.com/ stores
slash
double dash threat. Just go to the thing. Brett will have it listed there.
Click on the link in the show notes. Buy some merch. You'll love it. You'll be the most fashionable person in your town.
And if you come up with an I'm out design, that'll be the next shirt. What? Chris Pratt's voice? I'm out. Yeah, I'm out.
I'm back in. I'm back in.
I'm out.
I keep dropping out.
Every time I'm out,
I keep pulling myself back in.
I'm out. What? Godfather 3? I'm out. I'm back in. Every time I say I'm out,
it's like a cat trying to decide if he wants to go out or come back in.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks, everybody.
We're out.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ Forever Dog Team and liking our page on Facebook.